There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right. Welcome to Hour 2 of Midday Mobile. Jeff Porsche sitting in for Sean Sullivan. He'll be back in just a minute. I'm Dalton Orwig, and I want to talk to my buddy Angelo from Mobile Bay Coins and Fine Jewelry and see what's going on today. Angelo, how's it going?
Doing pretty good. How about yourself, Dalton?
I'm doing well, and, you know, Father's Day has come and gone, unfortunately. Our time in the spotlight is over, but still plenty of great gifts. I know a lot of people, well, most people, have family and friends that they want to shop for, and you have a great selection of stuff there at Mobile Bay Coins.
We really do, and a lot of folks have that person in the family that's always, quote-unquote, impossible to shop for, and I like to think that we excel at taking care of gifts for folks like that. When you look at the cool knives, all the cool gold and silver items, the jewelry, I mean, no matter what it is, we've probably got something here that's going to interest them.
Yeah, no doubt. And you brought one of those Opinel knives to me by the station earlier this week, and I love those. You have just an awesome selection of the Opinels.
Yeah, Opinels have been a really, really popular thing here at the shop, and we now are an official Opinel knife dealer. So pretty much anything you see on the Opinel website, if we don't have it in stock, we can certainly get it. And they do make a very high-quality knife. And I'm glad I picked out the right color for you. That was my only concern.
Yeah, you got my Tennessee Titans color, so I love it. Let people know the hours you're operating this weekend and where they can come find you.
Yeah, during the week, we're 9 to 5. Saturday's 9 to 2. We're in Midtown at 2204 Government Street. You can check us out online, mobilebaycoins.com, or like and follow us on Instagram and on Facebook.
All right, Angelo, have a good one.
You too.
That's Angelo, Mobile Bay Coins and Fine Jewelry. And now back to the regularly scheduled program with Jeff Poor in for Sean Sullivan.
Always a pleasure to be in with Dalton Orwig, who has held my hand throughout my my very young radio existence. The first time I filled in, one of the first times I filled in was in this studio before I went on to do things in Huntsville, and Dalton was there for me every step of the way. So this is kind of a mentorship here.
No hand-holding anymore. You got this thing.
Kind of. I don't know. It's still a little awkward from time to time. Let's take some phone calls. Let's hear from Brian, wants to weigh in on the ongoing saga of Talladega Super Speedway. Brian, tell everybody what's on your mind.
Yeah, so I was just kind of aggravated at K.I.V. for apologizing for everybody in the state of Alabama. I didn't have nothing to apologize for. Especially after the fact that they found out that all it was a garage pull.
Yeah, and for those of you listening, Ivy put out a statement on Monday. So this alleged incident happened on Sunday night. Monday morning, the governor puts out a statement apologizing to Bubba Wallace on behalf of all Alabamians. And, you know, as it turned out, there was no need for a quote-unquote apology. So I'm curious where that goes as well. I believe Congressman Byrne put out an apology. Just why not wait and see what really happened before we start issuing these blanket apologies?
Our politicians just seem like they want to jump the gun.
Yeah, I agree with that, Brian. I think a little patience, a little discretion would have been called for in such an emotional tense situation.
And then you have the interview with Gail King. He backs off, and she's there trying to stoke the fires and keep it going.
Yeah, and because Wallace initially said, "Well, I know a noose, and I'm not going to let people besmirch my character." Then there was this bizarre, almost perverse incentive, it seemed, to keep the story going, even though we knew that it was not some kind of act of a hate crime or something of that nature.
Yeah, I mean, I just wish all this mess would be over with. I mean, this is was a monument thing, and wish Sandy Stinson to do something and let us know what he's going to do with Raphael Sims. I mean, it's sad what it is.
Hey, Brian, thanks for the call. It is. Admiral Sims going in the museum, right? The Mobile Museum. So he'll be there, I guess, if you want to go visit him. I do think that situation was a little weird one to me because it kind of happened by a decision, executive fiat, if you will, and there didn't seem to be a vote. Had the city council voted on it or something, I might be a little more okay with it. But you are violating the law, even though it is a civil statute that was violated. It's still a violation of the law, and if the democratically elected city council decided that was the proper course of action, well, why not put it up to a vote? You could station some police to make sure it's not defaced any further in front of it. Just give us a day. I think you probably would have won that vote, given the political climate in the city council. Let's hear from Stephen. Let's just talk about Clufford Grove. Stephen from Orange Beach, what's on your mind?
Hey, Jeff. It's been a while since we've been on the air together, but I've been watching some of these campaign commercials and listening to some of them from this Club for Growth. And our good friend Quinn Hillier had a Facebook post the other day about the Congressional District 1 race. And, you know, I refuted Jerry Curry when Bill Hightower came out about the Schillinger's Road Project, which is an outright lie, and Sean and I talked about it on the air a couple weeks ago about how I negotiated that deal. Jerry Curry had nothing to do with it. Then I heard the radio commercial from Clubs for Growth pertaining to Jerry Curry paying for $180,000 for a tennis tournament. Well, when I was a commissioner, I paid $1 million. You know why? Because the tennis tournaments and the tennis center brought more revenue in. There's three things that bring in revenue: golf courses, parking decks, and tennis tournaments. And so I listen to these commercials and see how they have just absolutely, I've been through politics, as you know, my whole life. I've never seen it so disingenuous in many aspects for the Club for Growth and these PACs that come up against people like a good man like Jerry Curl, which of course I support, but that's neither here nor there. I've asked you, I've asked Quinn, where is the bench of political leaders? We're going through some tremendous times now, not only with the COVID-19, the economy, what the election is going to bring up in the next 6 months, where the Republican Party is in the state of Alabama. I've consistently asked you and many others, where is the bench? Where are the new rising leaders who are going to put themselves in the position of running for office and taking over this calamity of, it seems as though on every level, local, state, particularly federal level that we have, and I keep asking, how are we going to, if we have Club for Growth running ads like this, which are total outright lies against Jerry Curl, how are you going to get, or anybody get people to run for office anymore when it's so slanderous and so nasty? And that doesn't even take into effect of what we're going through with the racial divide in this country right now, which there is none. I've been through the same process, as you know, back in 2004 when I ran for county commission. There was a big upheaval, and race was brought into it, but I never allowed it to factor into serving the people.
Hey, State Commissioner, thanks for the call. Former Mobile County Commissioner Stephen Nodine. A couple of things there. It's just part of the process. To get elected, you've got to go through these things. In a perfect system, we wouldn't have Club for Growth running attack ads. We wouldn't have attack ads, but that, I think, if you can manage a campaign through those sort of contentious situations, those controversial situations, well, it's going to position you better as an elected official. Now, on your second point, I agree with you about the bench. You know, you don't hear a lot of the young up-and-coming names like you once did, perhaps. So I think there's certainly something to that. I don't know, but on your point about Club for Growth and attack ads, I think that's just part of the game. We got to be right back. We got to take a break. This is FM Talk 106.5.
is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back to FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile. Jeff Poore filling in for the legendary Sean Sullivan on this Friday afternoon. We're still awaiting Congressman Mo Brooks. Maybe he'll call in here in just a little bit. Always a pleasure to have him on. Tell you a bit about myself before we proceed. I am a frequent guest on this station, but also you can read me in Lanyap, lanyapmobile.com. Also, Breitbart News and Yellowhammer News. And if you're ever in the Huntsville area, go tune in to WVNNS 92.5 on your FM dial, 770 on your AM dial. Do an afternoon show up in Huntsville, the Tennessee Valley. All of that housekeeping out of the way. Hope everyone's doing well on this Friday afternoon. Coronavirus numbers are on the uptick here. And I mentioned this a little bit earlier. The fear here is that we might be looking at another situation where we have to backtrack and we have to go back into some kind of shutdown or some kind of lockdown. They're going to shut businesses down. I just don't think there's the appetite for that right now. I would be hesitant to tell you that's coming, but you may see some things going on that are kind of like what the city of Montgomery has done. The city council voted not to do it, but I think one wayward member turned around and went the other direction and said, I changed my mind. You may see some mandatory face mask orders. You may see some things of that nature coming. I'd be on the lookout for something like that. All right, joining us now, he represents 5th Congressional District up in North Alabama. My friend Congressman Bro Brooks is on the line. Congressman, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well. I apologize. I just got through voting on the House floor on whether to give the city of Washington 2 U.S. senators.
Yeah, I saw your remarks about that, giving D.C. statehood. Those of you in D.C. or have ever been up there, the other license plate, it says taxation without representation. But this looks like just one of the more shameless ploys by Democrats to more of a messaging thing, because it doesn't seem like it goes any further than what we saw today, right?
Well, I pray it won't go any further than today. We'll see how that plays out. For those who are unaware, we have some precedents over how to handle this. Back in the 1800s, Virginia, which had contributed some of the square mileage for the creation of the District of Columbia, said, hey, how about give us our land back? And the federal government did that. And then those people who now live in Northern Virginia, like Arlington, Alexandria, that neck of the woods, they now can vote on 2 U.S. senators, but they're Virginia senators. And the reasonable compromise is to let the Maryland part of the District of Columbia go back to Maryland.
So you would keep just the vicinity around the federal government buildings and the Capitol and the White House, that would remain in District of Columbia, but those places like Northwest D.C., Northeast, Southeast, that could go back to Maryland.
Sure, we've got some Marine barracks to the south of the Capitol, the Capitol itself, the Mall, all the monuments, the White House. All of the federal buildings that we have here that constitute the central government, we could put all of those in the District of Columbia and give the residential areas to Maryland, and that would solve the problem. But that's not what the Democrats want. They want two more socialist senators, and so they're depriving Washington, D.C. residents of voting rights on U.S. senators by insisting that they have their own state rather than going back to Maryland. To kind of put it into perspective, it'd be akin to us making a state out of Jefferson County, Alabama, or Mobile, Alabama, just making that into a state, giving them a congressman and 2 U.S. senators. Obviously, that's not right. They should not have the power of statehood.
I mean, even if they tried this and they weren't specific about what they were trying with the District of Columbia, it could be unconstitutional. It could be struck down by the court, right?
Well, that gets into a legal issue as to whether we can do this by statute or whether we have to do it by constitutional amendment. I personally believe that it has to be done by constitutional amendment, which means that 34 state legislatures would have to concur with it. If my math is right, is it 34 or 36? Maybe you can do the math right offhand, whatever two-thirds is. It might be three-fourths to actually ratify a constitutional amendment, two-thirds to create one that the states can then vote on. But it's a big number. It's in the 30s. And they're not going to get 30-something states to agree to a constitutional amendment that dilutes the powers of the 50 states.
Congressman, short on time here, but something else I wanted to get to while we got you. The police reform thing, the Senate bill didn't even make it out of, past the threshold for debate. But on the House side, there is one of these far left leaning proposals by Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats. But does it seem to you that Democrats want to keep this issue alive for the 2020 election campaign?
Absolutely. The Democrats are anti-police. Keep in mind the constituency of the Democratic Party. People who engage in crime, they're not supporting Republicans. They are a significant constituency in the Democratic Party, and to a very large degree, that explains the hesitancy of so many Democrat governors and so many mayors who refuse to enforce the law. They're afraid that they'll lose a block vote in a Democrat primary when they come up for re-election, hence the problem that we have.
And to piggyback on that topic, this craze with the mob and these monuments going down and things like that, it seems to me that there are already laws on the books. There's existing laws that protect these institutions and these monuments, and they're just, do you get the sense that we're just not enforcing them? I'm talking about on the federal level specifically, though. Are you concerned about kind of this trend?
Well, on the federal level, we are going to be enforcing the law, but not all destruction of property, not all the riots involve violation of federal statutes. That's where you get into municipal ordinances or state laws. That's where you get into the politics of whether it is advantageous or disadvantageous for the mayors or the governors to push for enforcement of these laws. They're counting heads. They're afraid they're going to lose votes if they enforce the law. That is why the rioting has gotten as bad as it has. And that's what we're looking at nationwide, the more these socialist Democrats gain power.
But the federal level, these national monuments, the ones we see in Washington, D.C., we saw one go down Albert Pike last week. You hear the talk about Mount Rushmore being threatened. These ones that are under the protection of the federal government, does the Department of Justice or whatever mechanism that's there, the Department of the Interior, do they need to be more aggressive in protecting these monuments?
That is the position of the House Freedom Caucus, of which I am a member. Last night I met with President Trump's chief of staff for dinner, Mark Meadows. He and I were sitting next to each other. That certainly was a paramount item of discussion. In my judgment, you're going to see sometime soon a significant number of arrests related to those who have committed these criminal acts. And I hope that they will be able to get convictions for the arrests that come from these investigations.
Congressman, we've got to leave it there. We're out of time, but thank you for joining us on such short notice and making time for us.
Certainly, Jeff. Keep up the good work of helping people understand the serious challenges that America faces.
As always, Congressman Mo Brooks represents the folks in North Alabama in the 5th Congressional District. Always a pleasure to have him on. So I think that's a good sign of things to come, that we're finally going to get to see perhaps some action on this, because if you haven't been aware, if you haven't been watching, it seems like there are people running free rein. The mob is running free rein in Washington, D.C. They put up National Guard troops around the Jefferson Memorial, the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial. Those are targets of the quote-unquote mob. But they're not armed. These National Guardsmen aren't armed, but I guess they're holding their own. But what would happen, ladies and gentlemen, if we had a Democrat president, if you had Joe Biden as your president of the United States? What would that look like? Would he protect those? And it's not clear to me that he would. So that just, it's very uncomfortable to think that we could see the any of those monuments on the Mall, the National Mall, defaced. We got to take another timeout. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
And it's Jeff Poore filling in for the great Sean Sullivan. I want to thank Sean Sullivan for letting me sit behind his mic this afternoon. Always a pleasure to talk to the FM Talk 106.5 audience. As Sean's taken an abbreviated early start of the weekend. Hopefully he is making the most of it. Mayor Bowser, we were just on the phone with Congressman Mo Brooks up in North Alabama. Very outspoken about this notion that Washington, D.C. deserves a statehood. Muriel Bowser is her name. She kind of inserted herself into the Black Lives Matter controversy, 16th Street, which runs straight down into the White House. If you're familiar with Washington, D.C., she painted in yellow paint on the road, Black Lives Matter, hailed by the media as now the next great civil rights warrior in this fight. But she says it's anti-American that Washington, D.C., is not a state. That is a very strange situation there. I've spent a lot of time in D.C., and I mentioned this a little earlier, on their license plates. If you go to a license plate in Washington, D.C., it says taxation without representation, and there's always been this kind of push for statehood in Washington, D.C., and it's never really amounted to much. I think back in the early 2000s, they were trying to work out a deal. This is when George W. Bush was president, where you would give, I think, Utah an extra congressman, and D.C. could have a congressman. But all of these fixes are unconstitutional. When our founders put together the country, they didn't want government having representation in government. And then that's the rub. So you could retrocede some of the territory, as Congressman Brooks pointed out. Arlington, Virginia, Alexandria, Virginia, parts of Falls Church used to be in the District of Columbia. You can look at old maps. It's a quadrangle. It's a square, essentially, where those cities used to be part of D.C. In the 1800s, they gave it back to the state of Virginia, and probably now, 100 years later, 200 years later, looking back at it, and you think, that's why Virginia is now a blue state, because you have government, you have these government employees that work on the other side of the Potomac River that make Virginia's politics more left-leaning. Otherwise, it'd probably be a more conservative state, probably closer to North Carolina. But a lot of this is electoral politics as well. Presidential politics is about the Electoral College. They expect real thin margins in the Electoral Colleges. I think we're always going to have the situation where a 50-50 country, that it's a jump ball in any presidential election, and anything you could do to help Democrats, it's all about power. Every conversation is about power and getting that power. Now, they would argue that the ends will justify the means and whatnot. That's the same with this mail-in balloting thing, mail-in voting. That's a conversation where you just get your ballot mailed to you, regardless if you're registered or you may have deceased or whatever. You don't do it the absentee ballot way. Right now in Alabama, you take an application, you have to fill it out, you either get a witness or you get it notarized, and you send it to your probate court, and they will send you a ballot, and then you can put it in the mail. That's how we do vote by mail. In Alabama, there's a couple of steps involved. There's a layers of protection to make sure that people that are voters are actually getting those ballots. What a lot of people propose, particularly on the left, Stacey Abrams, the failed gubernatorial candidate on the Democrat side of 2018, they would not even have you show up at the polls. You would just get your ballot mailed to you. You wouldn't have to go to the polls. And that's how they would do it. Some places are already doing that. And that makes, when you start expanding the voter pool, the belief, the wisdom, the conventional wisdom is that that becomes more of a Democrat-leaning voting block. Because more people, Democrats are, for whatever reason, less likely to go to the polls and participate in the civic process and wait in line. I guess Republicans are more likely to. I don't know where that is. There's a scientific data to back that up, but that's the belief at least. And that's why you see Kamala Harris, all these national, pseudo-national figures trying to push this mail-in balloting thing. And I don't take them at their word. Excuse me, but for being insensitive, but I don't take them at their word that they're doing this because they want to prevent the spread of COVID-19. It is a contradiction to see the media and the left do this, where they on one hand will talk about mail-in balloting and voting and all that, but on the other side of that, cheered on these protests. We have all these people in a fixed location that could be spreading the virus back and forth. So, with that going on, are we supposed to take this seriously? But I do think it gives Democrats something to run on in 2020. Does it ever happen? There's a lot of hurdles to overcome. It's decided at the state level. You're not going to be able to federalize it. Here's where the federal government could come into this. Here's what the federal government could do. They could incentivize it. Congress could pass a law and say, we'll give you X amount of money if you do mail-in balloting. And they could say, well, this is money for this. They want to take money from the CARES Act, just $3 trillion or whatever, and give it to states to be able to expand their ability to do mail-in balloting. But we talked to John Merrill last time I was on for Sean, and the logistics are just overwhelming to do this. Because, first of all, you can't just mail in the votes and they won't be counted. The way that will work is they are mailed in, and then you got to have a place to store them. You got to have people to count them. You got to have to check them against the voter. I mean, there's a lot involved in changing the election systems. There's a lot that entails. So we can't just flip the switch overnight. Now, will this be tried in the future? I think it will be. But I'm not sure that we will have a coronavirus pandemic as a backdrop or as an excuse for mail-in voting to be a thing, if you will. But that's out there. It's become an election issue. They're going to talk more and more and more about it. I think in Alabama we're safe. But watch some of these other Democrat states try to do this. The trick with that is those states are going to go Democrat anyway. They don't really need to do this with their voting and their balloting system. They don't need to do any of that. Those states weren't going to go for Trump in the first place. It's when you start seeing these swing states, when you start seeing Ohio, when you start seeing potentially Michigan or Pennsylvania, that these states that went for Trump in the 2016 election start to do this and try to put the system in at the last minute. That's when it becomes a dangerous situation. All right, folks, I got to get out of here. Coming up next, Sean Sullivan's conversation with Eaton Bart-Bernard of Taylor Martino. As always, I want to thank Sean for letting me sit in for him. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile, and a new face from a familiar name here. Eaton Barnard joining us in studio with Taylor Martino. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I grew up with some of the attorneys at Taylor Martino. I've gotten to meet so many others. I mean, you think about Richard Taylor, Steve Martino, Ed Rowan, Ruth Carmichael, Ben Kearns. And then I hear they've grown the family even more, and I'm getting introduced to you today. So thanks for stopping by. First of all, let's talk about you, because this is how we do stuff in Mobile. Let's talk about your background. You're from here.
Yeah.
Went to school here. Went to college here.
Yep. I was raised probably less than 2 miles from where we sit, behind what was the old Grady Buick.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Morningside, Mertz, Mayeens, and then went to Davidson High School, graduated from Davidson High School.
Then you attend the University of South Alabama.
Worked at JCPenney for 7 years during high school and college.
Went for the kids, there used to be a store called JCPenney's. Y'all had, they used to have a big catalog and all that. So you were there and then went on to decide you're going to practice law.
Yeah, well, I always knew I was going to practice law. I did.
Wait. Like, how far back?
Well, I'll put it this way. From the time that I was 14 and I thought I'd wanted to be a veterinarian and worked for a veterinarian for one summer and decided I did not want to be a veterinarian. So. Okay. I knew I didn't want to be a veterinarian, but I wanted to help people. I wanted to be a lawyer. I knew. And then I went to, I was a runner for a law firm in town. Absolutely.
You liked
smitten.
It.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's good to have that direction at such an early age. And obviously that's going to have served you well over the years. You have that kind of inner fire for this. And I want to talk about that because I want to talk about, the practice of law, but also specifically being a trial attorney, being a person that goes into a courtroom. There's all kind of different law, but I mean, it's a certain breed as a trial attorney, somebody that goes and takes a case in front of a jury.
It is, and it's somebody, you have to have passion for what you do.
Right.
You have to have a love of people and be willing to listen to people and to be able to delve into things and to see things differently than everybody else sees them, I guess is the best way to put it.
Well, I mean, you do, and to be, which obviously you're a good trial attorney, part of the family at Taylor Martino, you have to be able to, I guess, understand people and their issues that may not be yours, right? I mean, if you're trying a case, it's something that's never maybe happened to you, something you haven't dealt with, you now have to put yourself in their shoes, to be cliche.
That's exactly right. And that's why I spend probably an inordinate amount of my time when I first meet clients, like no less than an hour and a half, sometimes 2.5, 3.5 hours to get to know them. Because if you spend enough time with somebody, you'll find a reason to like them.
Right. Well, and if you're going to be there, I mean, essentially in our system, we hire you to represent us.
Right.
That means something.
That means I work for you.
Right.
You don't work for me.
Right.
And so I consider it an honor when somebody is willing to allow me to represent them. I don't feel like it's some privilege that I'm entitled to. I always consider it an honor. I really do.
For us, it's so important when we're hiring somebody because you then become me.
That's
you are my advocate. My situation is in your hands.
My clients are my friends from the time that we meet until hopefully death. I give my clients my cell phone number from day one. And it's on my card so that my clients want to reach me. They can reach me. They don't have to go through any steps. And I tell them, you could text me or email me, and I'm more likely to respond to you later on. But I will respond to your call within 24 hours, no matter what. But they're my friends. And I still maintain friendships with a lot of my old clients.
I don't know how you couldn't be drawn to that, right? As much as you take on our situation, trying to get justice for somebody, it seems like that's pretty personal.
You develop a really strong bond with these people when you go from first meeting them all the way through a jury trial and sometimes even appeal. Yeah, you develop a bond because in jury trial, you spend literally days with your clients, 12, 14 hours a day, very close together doing the trial itself.
And then, Eaton, you're talking about the work you do beforehand. We were talking before we even started during the news break, and you were kind of recounting, we're talking about different, different years of your life and cases and just the amount of time, like in the weeks preceding a trial.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key to any case is that you have to have a good case, but then you have to develop that case. You have to do the work that it takes to get that case ready for trial. And I think that one thing that might separate me a little bit is when a client hires me, I tell them, look, there's a 95% chance your case is going to settle, but I'm preparing your case for trial starting today so that if you decide you want to go to trial, we will be ready for trial. We won't have to start figuring out how to put stuff together because we hadn't done our job. And that's what I do. I start preparing for trial from day one.
I see why you get along with the crew there at Taylor Martino, because I think there's a bunch of y'all in there that like to go to trial. And that, I imagine a defense attorney can sniff out when there's, a plaintiff's attorney that they know likes to go to trial.
They know. The lawyers know, the judges know, the insurance companies know the difference between people who claim to be trial lawyers and people who go to the courthouse. They know the difference.
If somebody's listening that doesn't do what you do every day, explain that. Why is that important that they know that you'll go to trial?
Well, because I told a client today, we're mediating her case Thursday.
Okay.
And she said, I told her, clients always come to me and say, what would you do? And I tell them, I don't make that decision for you because I'm not risk averse. I like risk. I want to go to trial.
Right.
And so it's not fair for me to put my risk factor on you My job is to tell you what I think all the good things are about your case, all the bad things are, mm-hmm. and let you make the decision based on my knowledge. And I read, eat, sleep, drink, trial, and the psychology of it, and jury selection, and case preparation, and laws, and regulations, and safety things all the time. I enjoy it. That's what I read.
That's your thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a good thing to have an attorney that is that is your hobby and your job and your passion there. And that does get into some of the things that people think, well, okay, so Eaton Barter is a great attorney. Look at him work in the courtroom. But you mentioned like the psychology of a courtroom. That's a big field of study for people in
law. It is. And when I first started, I thought when I'm presenting this, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, I would say, well, let me tell you about my client, how bad my client is. But in truth, what the jury wants to know, or what you want the jury to do, is focus on the defendant, mm-hmm. what they did wrong.
Right.
And so you don't bring your client in until after you've psychologically gotten the jury on your side.
And I mean, that's something that you study that. We all think, of course, you go to law school, you do that, you learn the laws, you're doing the continuing legal education, you know all those things, but you like got a psychology degree going on the side there.
90% of what we do is sales and psychology.
See, that's fantastic. All right, I would talk about this too. If people go check out votenappies.com, you're nominated for a nappy, and pretty heady stuff because only 6 attorneys named there, and I'm not going to disparage the profession, but there's a bunch of attorneys in our area.
That's true.
So, I mean, it's quite cream of the crop there.
Well, you know, I'm a little embarrassed about that.
Yo, because this was thrown on you, right? This is a thing you didn't ask for, you didn't campaign for, but it's thrown on you. But it's a good thing. It means people out there in the community like your work.
Well, I mean, I'm very humbled and honored by the fact that actually it had to be more than one person took the time and opportunity to nominate me, and I had absolutely nothing to do with it.
Embrace it. Embrace it. Okay, let's talk about the procedure of getting in touch with you. Somebody's listening to us right now and says, that's the person I want representing me.
Right.
Now, what do they do? First step, they've been injured. Something has happened. Something's happened to them through no fault of their own. So what do they do? Pick up the phone, walk us through that process.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, they can call the law firm, Taylor Martino, if they remember that. That's easiest. Mm-hmm. My cell phone number is pretty easy. It's 251-604-0400.
I love that.
So, you know, they can call me directly, and I'm blessed to be busy, so I may not call them back in the next 15 minutes, but I will call them back. And I, you know, like I said, I'm very fortunate that a lot of people call me.
When we come meet with you, plan a little bit of time, because it sounds like there's a lot of getting to know us.
Right. Honestly, I like to go to my clients' houses to meet with them. I've always learned a lot more.
You pick up things?
Right. They are more comfortable in their own home than they are in some stuffy law firm conference room.
Yeah. You said it. I didn't say they were stuffy, but you did. Yeah, I agree.
I'm comfortable anywhere.
Right.
It's like I told somebody today, one of my first client meetings, I had to go to a mobile home on Highway 90. A guy had been horribly injured in a motorcycle wreck, and he had a colostomy bag on.
Oh, my gosh.
And I went in the door, and it was the winter, and it was about 40 degrees outside, and it was about 80 degrees inside.
Had the heat up.
And the husband and the wife were both smoking.
Wow.
And I walked in, and I saw his colostomy bag, and she was cooking split pea soup.
I'll leave it at that.
It speaks for itself.
That is for sure.
But you still learn something when you go to somebody's house.
No, and the people like you that are so good at this, I've learned that y'all, whether it's psychology of a jury or maybe something we wouldn't even think to tell you. Now, absolutely. I wouldn't even think to tell you. You'll see something that will pull that important question out.
Yeah, and even things that, like you said, some people won't tell you things. Like
right.
I had a police officer one time who I thought he was faking the whole time because he'd been in a relatively minor wreck. But he said he couldn't drive, he couldn't drive, couldn't drive. After 3 years, I learned that he had post-traumatic stress disorder. He could not drive. It just absolutely freaked him out.
But he
didn't want to admit that because he was a former Marine.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been a police officer for 17 years. He didn't want to tell his boss, hey, look, I'm scared to drive.
Right.
I don't know what happened, but it flipped a switch on me, and I'm literally scared to drive any vehicle anytime. And I took 3 years fighting with that guy, not believing him until we really delved into it and found out what really happened and what was really going on. And that was on the way to the courthouse. His wife said, I said, well, are you going to drive the course? And she said, oh, he never drives. I said, never? She said, never. She said, I had a heart attack and he had to drive me to the hospital. And I thought he was going to have a heart attack driving me to the hospital. He was so anxious by the time he got sweating and scared.
What an important thing for you to be able to relay to a jury.
Absolutely. Well, actually, it was just a judge in this case, okay. But it was very persuasive. It was very persuasive.
All right. Once again, the cell phone or calling Taylor Martino to get that appointment right. Set, get you to come to our house and talk with us and find out about our situation.
Right. Yeah. And I'm Eaton at TaylorMartino.com or the Taylor Martino number, which I think is 251-433-3131, but y'all might want to double check that because I give everybody my cell phone number.
I like that. That cell phone number again?
251-604-0400.
I love it. I love that attitude. Enjoyed talking with you. I see why you're a great fit for Taylor Martino. Eaton Barnard, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sean. Appreciate it.
You can reach Taylor Martino Law Firm online, TaylorMartino.com. That's TaylorMartino.com. No representation is made that legal services performed are greater than the quality of legal services of others.